This is Radio Boston. I am Tiziana Deering, and if you're fully vaccinated, you can be indoors with others without masks under some circumstances. Now, this breath of fresh air to everyone from grandparents to best friends came courtesy of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention this morning when they released new guidelines for what people fully vaccinated against COVID-19 can do safely now. It comes as state health data show about 700,000 people in Massachusetts, that's about 10% of the population, are fully vaccinated. It also gives the kind of hope that some public health professionals feel should be more present in our safety messaging. So let's talk about the new guidelines, and let's talk about how we talk about what we can and can't do in this pandemic. Joining us, Professor Julia Marcus, epidemiologist and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Julia Marcus, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start, Professor Marcus, with the guidelines, because they just came out this morning. So many people were waiting for them. Were you relieved when they came out and you saw them today?
Relieved is an understatement. I was delighted. I have to say, as a caveat, I haven't had a chance to read every word. I was writing a grant and then emerged and saw all the excitement about this. And so I have taken a look at the guidelines. I just haven't been able to read in detail, but I think they look fantastic and really reasonable and evidence-based.
So let me pull out a couple things that stood out for me. The CDC now says that vaccinated people can gather unmasked with people from another household who are not yet vaccinated. The caveat there that is that as long as those people are at low risk of serious illness from the virus. So let's say you are grandparents who are vaccinated. You can go to the household of your grandchildren as long as everyone in that household is low risk for serious illness, even if they're not vaccinated. This is huge. Grandparents are just one group for whom that's got huge implications. Do you feel like we're ready for that, or were we ready for it, 6 months ago? What's your reaction?
I think we are ready. I think that there are challenges with undoing all the kind of efforts that we have made to take these precautions. I think we've strongly associated, and appropriately during a pandemic, have strongly associated certain behaviors, particularly being indoors with people, unmasked, not distanced, with something that's very high risk. And I think what the CDC is telling us now is that with these vaccines, that risk calculation changes, as it should. But I think approaching this with caution is appropriate, and they're not telling people you can go back to life as normal right now. They're telling people, here are some small changes you can make in your everyday lives that may actually make kind of a large difference for people, even though they're going to continue to take precautions in public for the time being.
I noted you talked about the risk of, we don't want to undo the progress we've made in convincing people about how to be safe. I'm looking at the CDC website right now under the section, what hasn't changed. A couple of the bullets: you should still avoid medium or large size gatherings. You should still delay domestic and international travel. If you do travel, you still need to follow the CDC requirements and recommendations. You will still need to follow guidance at your workplace. In the public health community, is there concern that when good news comes about loosening practices, for example, for subpopulations, that spills over and everybody loosens up when they shouldn't? Is that a thing?
I think there are concerns about that. I'm not too concerned about that here. I think that people understand when they've been vaccinated or they're around other people who are vaccinated, how that risk calculus changes, and that's what the CDC is helping people do in a nuanced way with these guidelines. I don't think that the existence of vaccines and, the knowledge that people are starting to be vaccinated is going to be enough for people to start taking more risks in their own lives. I don't think people's, everyday considerations about risk take into consideration that other people are experiencing reduced risk, if that makes sense. So I'm not too concerned about that. I do think I like that the CDC is making this distinction between public and private settings. I think that's important. I think some of the really strong messaging that we were hearing, particularly in the media, as vaccines, the good data on vaccines started to emerge, we saw a lot of articles, nothing changes for you after vaccination. Don't think you can take your mask off. And I think a lot of that came from the need to emphasize continued precautions in public settings. And I think that that's right for now until many more people have had a chance to be vaccinated. But the CDC is recognizing that not all interactions happen in public. Many of them happen in private spaces. And just these small changes that allow, one or two households to start interacting, I think is going to make a big difference in people's lives.
I want to stay with that for a minute because it strikes me that it's possible that these small changes, while important, can also be confusing when sort of translated in the public sphere. And let me juxtaposition for a minute. So now you've got the CDC happily talking about some circumstances where people who are vaccinated can really be with other people, not wear a mask, let their guard down a little bit, again, under certain circumstances. On the flip side, within the last month, we've heard both President Biden and Dr. Anthony Fauci talk about the possibility that we're still masking into 2022. That feels a little like messaging whiplash. And one is relieving, and the other is a sucker punch. So how do we think about that, and how does the everyday person survive that kind of whiplash and know what to do?
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I feel the whiplash myself between feeling just incredible optimism about these vaccines and what they can do for us, and also some of the uncertainty about emerging variants and how long it will take to get the population vaccinated. But I think every day we're hearing good news about new vaccines that are going to increase supply, and the timeline for getting most adults vaccinated is getting shorter. So I am not, I defer to Dr. Fauci, but I have hope that we will not be wearing masks in 2022. But I will say, there are going to be people who are never vaccinated, who either because they are unable to be vaccinated because of contraindications, or because they're unwilling, or hopefully we don't have this situation, but they may not have gotten access, even though they sort of theoretically should. And we're certainly seeing access issues and equity issues in vaccine distribution now that will hopefully be alleviated over time. Children are another population that is not going to be vaccinated on the same timeline as adults. And so I think there are questions about what this will look like, let's say in the fall, with kids back in school when most adults have been vaccinated, not all, and kids have not probably yet been vaccinated. So, what will there be a need to continue wearing masks? I don't know.
So I want to talk about an Atlantic article from late February about the five mistakes we keep repeating in this pandemic. You're quoted in it, pushes back on some of our public health messaging and mistakes it has made that may have either undermined the messages or demoralized folks. One of the things it does is push back on the idea that strict rules are useful versus sort of common sense guidelines, especially in an environment where the circumstances are understanding, those are changing. What have we done wrong in our public health messaging, do you think?
That is a big question. I'll start with what you just mentioned, which was one of the parts of that article was addressing strict, particularly binary rules. So I think it's less about the strictness and more about kind of the danger of oversimplification and how that can sometimes replace the intuition that people need to guide their everyday decisions. So, we could think about a number of, very binary rules around, let's say, distancing that I think sometimes took over in places where actually ventilation was more important, for example. So I think you have to give people metrics that they can use. We can't always give people information that's, on a probability scale or continuum as much as we do want to convey a spectrum of risk. I think sometimes you do need to draw the line somewhere to give people some guidelines. But we also have to give people intuition so that they are empowered to make their own decisions because things don't always fit neatly into those binaries.
I remember over the past year you talking with us here on Radio Boston about the importance of not shaming people for their needs, for example, family time, but instead helping people focus on the safest way to get those needs met, to do it. And that has rung to me of compassion and empathy. I don't mean to sound combative with our public health messaging, but have we missed some of the empathy gene in the way we've talked to people about how to be safe, how to protect ourselves and others? Versus what their emotional needs are, their social emotional needs, their mental health needs.
I think there has been, a lot of messaging coming from a lot of different parties in this pandemic. And certainly during the last administration, the CDC was very quiet. And so there were a lot of different messengers stepping in to fill that gap, everyone from politicians to individual experts talking to the media, the media itself, the journalists trying to fill that gap as well. And so it's hard to sort of pin down the messaging, but I think there, I think some of that compassion has gotten a little lost. And I think in particular, we have not necessarily considered certain things essential that are essential and incorporated that into messaging and policy. And I think social connection is one of those things. And of course, that doesn't mean, partying is a need. But I think in general, connecting with other human beings is a fundamental need. And so I think approaching the way that we message about risk and the way that we design policies to reduce risk, when we keep in mind what it is that people really need and also what they really want out of their lives, I think we end up with more effective messaging and policies.
There's one other thing around messaging. We're starting to try to kind of learn now from a year of this, right? And I know over the last year, on air with our guests and with processing the information that's come along, there's been some struggle with what feels like a pitting of the economic and the public health against each other. Some guests have kind of dismissed that out of hand, but others have said, yeah, there is a framing out there that pits our economic well-being against our public health well-being. Like if you follow the public health measures, that's bad for the economy and vice versa. Is that a necessary framing? I mean, are those things pitted against each other? And could we have done a better job with that framing and discussion?
I think it's a false dichotomy and an oversimplification to say that the economy and public health are at odds, or that if you have if you're prioritizing one, you must be deprioritizing the other. I do think much of our public health policies have unfortunately been driven by economic pressures, and that the lack of federal support over the last year, I think that obviously is changing now, but the lack of federal support over the past year has driven some unfortunate decision making at the state and local levels because there was not enough support, let's say, pay certain kinds of workers to stay home, or to give support to schools or workplaces to implement risk mitigation measures. So, I think the economic part of things sort of I don't think those two things are at odds as long as the resources are there to implement these public health measures. And they unfortunately were not for quite some time, but hopefully that's going to look different over these next few months.
And in just a couple of sentences, you told our producer Paris Alston earlier, we're not out of the woods, but we can see the clearing beyond the trees. Is that how you feel now?
I really do. I mean, despite that whiplash we talked about, I think my optimism is generally outweighing any sense of doom that I have right now. I think, we would never have thought that a year ago, we never would have expected to have a number of effective vaccines, very highly effective vaccines by now. And I think that should bring us all a lot of hope.
That's good news. And that is Professor Julia Marcus, an epidemiologist and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Thanks for the time today. Be well.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk now about Dr. Seuss, and you probably already know the controversy. So Dr. Seuss Enterprises is ending future publications of six Seuss books that include offensive imagery, such as depicting people of color through racist caricatures, using images that reinforce racial stereotypes. In a statement, Dr. Seuss Enterprises said, quote, "The books portray people in ways that are hurtful and wrong," end quote. Now, a firestorm has ensued since the news with claims of cancel culture. The books aren't being canceled. But the Springfield-born author and his estate have certainly given us cause to talk about stewardship of artistic works and when it's time for something to be sunsetted. So we want to invite you to join us to talk about this. What do you make of the recent controversy surrounding Dr. Seuss's legacy and those six books? Do you think it's cancel culture, or is this cultural wisdom? Where does this move fit in our current racial reckoning? And do you think taking the books out of publication was the right move? We welcome your thoughts at 800-4 238-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. We have two guests for this discussion. First, Boston Globe film critic and columnist Ty Burr, and also Tricia Elam Walker, writer and assistant professor of fiction and creative nonfiction at Howard University. Ty, Tricia, welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So, Ty, I want to turn to you right out of the gate because I understand that you're kind of frustrated to even have this conversation, that so many people have bought the framing of cancel culture. So talk about that a little bit.
You know, I just feel like we walked into just an absolute, not a trap here, but we just fell for something here that was framed by Fox News and right-wing media to have a big cultural kerfuffle over something that is not that big, and we can get into that, because when we're talking about this, we're not talking about, you know, the Senate, you know, making a recovery deal. We're not talking about the attempts to stop voting and block voting down in the South and the Voting Rights Act. And we're not talking about all the things we actually need to be talking about. We're talking about six old Dr. Seuss books. And you know what? I fell for it. I wrote a column last week. You fell for it. We're having this conversation right now. There are other things to be talking about.
So I do wonder, though, Tricia, and Ty, I appreciate your point, but I do wonder if this invites us to have a little bit of a different conversation about thoughtful stewardship. So I'm thinking about, I'm thinking about both your column and also, Tricia, I'm thinking about Jabari Asim's point in the Boston Globe, that these are books that should be in the library, but probably also on request, or at least not in the picture book part of the children's section, because that's the more thoughtful approach to when and how young kids should encounter such content. So does this invite us to not fall into the trap Ty's talking about, but have a conversation about thoughtful stewardship?
Well, yes, and I agree with Ty. This is not about cancel culture. I think it's about evolution, it's about reckoning, it's about taking responsibility. And so I'm actually pleased and proud that, you know, the Seuss Enterprises did this because it seems very thoughtful. They looked at these books, they consulted with experts, and they realized that some of them didn't make sense at this time. They weren't contributing anything. As a matter of fact, they were detracting, and they were possibly being hurtful, as they said. And I think that's really important because one of the first rules to me about a children's book is it should never do any harm to a child.
So, Tricia, you had an early exposure because your mother was the head of the library program for the Boston Public Schools. What did you learn about Dr. Seuss back in those days, and how does it compare to the conversation we're having today?
Well, my mother, yes, she did that, and she was, she became sort of out of necessity, an expert about racism in children's books, because she was tasked with making sure Boston Public School libraries were filled with books for all children, in which all children felt good and felt celebrated. And I do recall that, and I don't know that they were these specific ones, but probably.
Okay, I think we might have lost Tricia there. And listeners, you didn't know this, but I think we actually had lost Ty. Tricia, do I have you back?
Yeah, somehow the mute came on by itself. In any case.
Okay, glad to have you back.
I don't know what you missed, but I was saying that my mother's job was to make sure, you know, the Boston Public Schools libraries were filled with culturally diverse books. And also, you know, when I grew up, there was a dearth of books about children that looked like me represented in a positive way. So she was always on a quest for that and really, you know, perturbed at the dearth. And when she would come across books that had representations that weren't positive, you know, those books were not the ones that we paid attention to or were able to, you know, explore further. And I remember her feeling that there were some Dr. Seuss books as well as some others, some books that I actually loved, like Pippi Longstocking and the, I think it's The Charlie and the Chocolate Factories and many others that had some issues in them. So while we still loved and read the other Dr. Seuss books, you know, she felt it was important that we not read the ones that might make us feel bad or might make us feel shame or might make us have questions that we didn't need to have at that point. A children's book should help a child celebrate him or herself, all kinds of children.
So you agreed with Ty, and Ty made a really compelling argument. We'll get him back in a minute. I know they're working on that now at the beginning of the segment, that we kind of fell into a trap in our public discourse on this because it was framed as these books being canceled. They are still in libraries. You can still buy them. They're just not going to be published anymore. But what about, Tricia, the concerns that this could represent the first step in a slippery slope? So you stop the publishing today, but that limits access. Tomorrow, the books eventually disappear over time. It has a chilling effect on other authors, potentially early in their career. So, you know, that argument is there too. What do you make of it, and what would you say to it?
I mean, I think that's a pretty weak argument. I think these are books that were already sort of kind of obscure. They were already books, you know, that people recognized had problems that weren't relevant. And there's so many others. And one of the things I think his estate said was, you know, they want to make room for more relevant books and books that are actually contributing positively to the conversation. So I don't really see it as a slippery slope. It's not being totally canceled. It's not being censored. It's just being moved out of the way for other books that can actually contribute in a much broader and more helpful way, I think.
I think we have Ty back now. So Ty Burr, welcome back. I was just asking Tricia about concerns that maybe this represents a slippery slope, that this is not a cancellation, but does it lead to a chilling effect? Does it lead to cancellation? Tricia answered that question. It made me think of another. You had a reader respond to the op-ed you told us you wrote that likened the ending of the publication of these titles to burning books. I do think it's important to call out that's a false comparison. These are books that are not being burned. They're still available. But talk about why it's a false comparison. And Ty, have you given any thought? Is there a comparison that you think is better and healthy in understanding why Seuss Enterprises is doing this in this moment and why these kinds of decisions are coming up now?
Well, for one thing, I would certainly agree. I was able to hear, even though I was cut off there for a bit. I certainly agree with Tricia when she talks about young kids of color trying to see themselves in these books, and they're not there. And I actually, there was one tweet that was put up by a guy named Michael Harriet that I'm just going to read because it clarifies things for me very well, where he said, here's the thing, I understand why they can't understand it. Who cares if Dr. Seuss was racist one time in that one book? Should he be canceled? They don't realize that the only time a black child saw themselves in a Seuss book was in a racist illustration. And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. But to your point, what I honestly, you know, in my column, I compared what's going on now to the early Tintin books by Hergé, which are really, yeah. Tintin and the Congo is a profoundly racist book. But it's not available to the family audience as part of the regular run of Tintin books. It is available in a scholarly edition for collectors, for academics. It's not gone. And even if that had ceased publication, you can still find copies of it pretty much everywhere. My point about them not publishing these six books is, well, first of all, it will still be available in libraries. Yes, it's $600 now on eBay, but after this hysteria dies down in 6 months, you'll be able to buy a copy of McGillicuddy's Pool for $25 or $10 on eBay. It's not going to be that much of a deal. Second, books go out of print all the time. The number of books out of print compared to the number of books in print is, you know, bigger by an order of magnitude. And third, I think it would probably behoove the Seuss estate to, at some point, make these things available in editions that discuss the issues, that frame them in terms of history, in terms of context, in terms of culture, and not put them out there for the kid market. But for now, I think it's a perfectly appropriate first step.
Right.
So go ahead, Tricia.
I'm so sorry. Some books.
No, no.
I heard LeVar Burton say some books just don't age well. And I think that's the case here. And I think we also have to prioritize the needs of children. And a lot of these discussions where people are talking about canceling and banning books, they're not thinking about the children here. And I just want to give you a quick example. I integrated a private school in Boston when I was 10 years old, and we had to read Huckleberry Finn, and we had to read it out loud. We had to read passages out loud. And I remember dreading and hoping I didn't have to read. I was the only black girl in that class. Hoping I didn't have to read, you know, a sentence with the word, but of course I did. And it was traumatizing. I mean, this is 60 something years ago. I still remember how I felt. I was holding back tears. I felt like the whole class was looking at me like I was, and you know, it was a problem, and it should not, I never was able to see the value of that book because of that trauma. And I don't think that should happen to a child. Children's books should be celebratory. Children should feel good after reading them. first, there should be no harm done. And what's represented about a particular child should be authentic and true.
So, Trish, I really appreciate that story, and I'm sorry for the pain of it. I also do want to acknowledge that you used a character name there that we don't usually use on air in public radio. And I just do want to acknowledge that for our listeners. It's not my main focus, though. My main focus is the pain of the story that you just told us, and the fact that this is where the engagement on this conversation goes now, that we are in a moment in our racial reckoning where we're having real conversations about the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves and how we can do better in that. I wonder, Ty and Tricia, if either of you have encountered books for children, books for young people that you feel are now the role models and maybe the future Seuss books we read our kids that are doing a better job of telling us the stories we tell about ourselves. And I'd invite listeners to call with those same thoughts. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tricia, well, maybe you first.
That's the wonderful thing. There are so many. There obviously could be more, but there are so many more books. I just also remember back in like 1962 when The Snowy Day came out, Ezra Jack Keats, the white writer.
Yeah.
He had this beautiful brown, velvety little black boy and his mom, and all he was doing was going snowing, and it just showed a black character doing a regular event, and it was a positive story. And then, you know, and then more and more of these kinds of books started coming out. So I'm actually a children's book writer myself, and that's one of the things I try to do, you know, with my books, is that really represent us authentically, positively, so that a child can read it and feel good. That's the objective.
Ty, any thoughts you want to add to that?
No, you know, my kids are grown, so I haven't read children's books in quite a while. I will, you know, absolutely reiterate the love of Ezra Jack Keats. His stuff is fantastic. I do think there, you know, when you look back at classic kids literature, we do have to read it with an open eye. But that said, there are plenty of examples there that you can find that are, you know, really challenging and enlarging and fulfilling without getting, you know, problematic. One, I'm thinking of like the work of Tove Jansson, the Moomin books, which are kids, you know, for kids like, you know, 7 to 11, but they are completely unobjectionable, but also impart lessons that are really, I think, useful and have a sense of poetry to them that I think are really good for children to sort of be exposed to.
So one of the things, Tricia, go ahead, Tricia.
A lot of them discuss topics that are difficult topics, you know, but
yes,
they do such a warm opening, wonderful way. I mean, Kwame Alexander has books like this, Jabari Yassin. My book is called Nana Kula Goes to School, about a little girl whose grandmother has traditional tribal markings on her face, and she's worried that the children at school might make fun of her, but she learns a lesson about that, you know, about appreciating and celebrating difference. And I think there is a richness now in the literature that I'm so thankful about.
I'd love to go to the phones here. We've got Antonio on the line from the West End who has a question for the two of you. Antonio, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, Tiziana, and thank you to the speakers for the wonderful context you're giving. I just wanted to know if you could add something about how nostalgia plays a big problematic part in addressing all these products. I grew up watching Tom and Jerry, and you know, now I realize that while it was a great introduction to classical music, it was also a great introduction, a terrible introduction to family racism. And I think that happens a lot with cartoons or short stories that a lot of us grew up with.
Antonio, thanks for the question. I want to give you both a chance to answer that. Ty Burr, I'll go to you first because I heard you giving some sounds of agreement there. So,
yeah,
Ty, why don't you start?
Well, I think one of the reasons this particular case is such a hot topic, and the reason that it's been leaped on by right-wing media, is that everybody loves Dr. Seuss because everybody read Dr. Seuss when they were a kid. And so it's innocent. It therefore represents their innocence. They didn't have a problem with it then. Why should anybody have a problem with it now? It goes to what I call the footy pajama theory, just with, you know, sort of sardonically referring to movies that you saw when you were young enough to be in footy pajamas, and then you love for the rest of your life because you have absolutely no critical distance on it whatsoever. For me, that's The Wizard of Oz. For some people, it's Star Wars. For some people, it's The Lion King. Whatever it is, these artifacts, and it's useful to think of them as cultural artifacts, they are so embedded in our childhood that it hurts to think of them as hurtful. And it's a challenge to us. And this is what I've been seeing in the response to my column and to Jabari's column and to, you know, the whole public discussion, is that people are angry because they feel personally attacked, because these are books that resonate with them on a personal level. And I understand. I love McGillicuddy's Pool. It's a beautiful piece of work. The illustrations are lovely.
Tricia, let me let you add on there.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think we also have to remember that, you know, our country is going through a difficult period right now with racial reckoning on many levels. And so we have to be, you know, aware of that. And there are all kinds of things that maybe we had felt nostalgic about in the past, but that are just not appropriate anymore. I think about the Native American mascots, you know, yeah. Those are the things that need to go at this point. Those old cartoons, yeah, my kids can't watch them. I couldn't watch them when they were growing up because they weren't appropriate anymore. So, I mean, we have to move forward. We have to continue to evolve with the evolution that is happening in our country and in our world.
So let's go to the phones here. We've got Lauren on the line from Winchester. Lauren, go ahead.
Hi, thank you guys so much for hosting this. I'm a mother of a 3.5-year-old, and I have struggled with finding books that have been diverse and representative. And it's a struggle raising a white child in this country, honestly, because, you know, you really want to provide as much diversity as you can. I just wanted to give a little shout out to a local press group. Mango and Marigold has a wonderful line of really diverse books, Mango and Marigold Press, and I've really found a good connection with them.
Great, Lauren. Thank you for that. So it's great to have those recommendations, you know, for parents to share with each other other things they're having their kids read. It does, Tricia, tie. It does also raise, I've heard parents having conversations now saying, well, wait a minute, does this mean I shouldn't read Green Eggs and Ham to my kids anymore? Or One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish? I hear from you that's probably not the message. But Tricia, we may as well take it head on. What about that?
No, I think keep reading those books. I don't see any issues with those books. I mean, Dr. Seuss himself evolved. He looked at some of the work that he did for some newspapers, the cartoons he made, and he felt embarrassed about them and didn't feel comfortable having those being shown anymore. So, I mean, what he tried to accomplish was to bring joy, to teach some things to kids, to have them be fun. And those books that are still available that don't have any of those problems in them serve that purpose.
Yeah, and
so,
I would chime in.
Go ahead, Ty.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go.
I would chime in that there's, along with Dr. Seuss, there's a sort of history of these mid-20th century illustrators who sort of come of age. And Hergé with the Tintin books is another example. His early books were really quite racist. Then he was befriended by a Chinese national who really opened his mind about depicting the other cultures in his books realistically and open-mindedly and democratically, and it really changed him. The same with Seuss. If you look at his early cartoons, they buy into the sort of the cultural blackface tropes of the 20s when he first started out. And you can see him evolve through his career to the end when he's, you know, doing the Lorax and the Butter Battle book, and he spoke of those early works as with shame. He was, you know, quite on the record about it with his family.
I think Roald Dahl tried to do that as well, didn't he? He went back and changed something, the Oompa Loompas, and I think that the Chocolate Factory books.
The Oompa Loompas were originally a tribe of black pygmies that were, quote, imported by Willy Wonka. The NAACP protested, and he heard them out, and he said, you know, once I heard them and other people, I had sympathy for them. So for the second edition, they changed the illustrations and he changed the descriptions in the book.
Right.
So we're coming close to the close here. There is one more question I want to ask you both to reflect on, which is we will continue to deal with this duality, which is so often the case of artists who move us and they teach us, but either they are also deeply flawed people, because many of us are, or they have some work that is flawed or represents a different time and needs to be reckoned with now. Is there a framework or a guide that you use? How do you think about encountering and thinking through that work? It comes up all the time in art. Tricia.
I feel like the test is, you know, can you read it to a child of color without them feeling shamed, without you having to change something because you realize, oh my gosh, there's a problem in this book. Can you do that? Can you read that book and the child feels celebrated and goes away feeling good about themselves and is not harmed, then it's okay.
And Ty, how about you?
I would say as somebody who has two kids in their mid-20s, you can read some of this stuff to them and they will respond sometimes with vehemence and horror at some of the things that are in these books. And that's a good conversation to start having. I'm not going to say that they're always going to be right, but that conversation, if you show some of these books to somebody, to a young person, to somebody of the younger generation, they will respond honestly. And it's a good litmus test of how things are playing in the culture now. And I think that's a good starting point to start arguing about how you deal with these particular works of culture in the culture. How you frame them. And again, I'm not at all in favor of banning the books, right. But framing them, contextualizing them, talking about them.
Well, that is Boston Globe film critic and columnist Ty Burr, and also Tricia Elam Walker, writer and assistant professor of fiction and creative nonfiction at Howard University. I want to thank the both of you for engaging in such a thoughtful and nuanced conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
As we heard earlier in the show, we have new CDC guidelines on how folks who are fully vaccinated can interact with each other. Now into the third month of vaccine eligibility, we want to check back in on a community that we have been following through this pandemic, our neighbors experiencing homelessness and housing insecurity. Lyndia Downey is the president and executive director of Pine Street Inn, the city's largest homeless shelter. She joins us on the line now. Lyndia, welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. So we've stayed in touch. Both WBUR and Radio Boston have stayed in touch with you, Lyndia, over the last 12 months. What is the situation right now at Pine Street Inn as we enter, you know, the anniversary, sadly?
Well, I think it's a mix of optimism, you know, gratitude that we were early in on the vaccine in phase one, and exhaustion, frankly. I think it's all three of those.
So, Lyndia, if you were going to sort of describe for us the arc of the last 12 months, both for residents at Pine Street Inn and for the experience of you and your team, you just talked about exhaustion, how would you describe that arc?
I think, you know, in the beginning, Tiziana, it was very literally putting out fires every day and trying to build that bridge while you were walking across it. You know, we were not quite sure what we were up against when we started universal testing, and the numbers were quite high. You know, we were testing in the worst months of this pandemic at 36% among the guests. Of course, that impacted our frontline staff, many of whom also tested positive. So we were trying to deal with a crisis with some days, you know, both hands tied behind our backs. The many staff were out. Even if they weren't sick, they had to quarantine. We had to very quickly find alternative space for guests that were staying in shelter. And for people who have not been to Pine Street, our shelter beds look like a big barracks. You know, the beds were maybe 2.5 feet apart. People, you know, slept next to each other very closely. People, even now, you know, eat together. People are together in the building all day. And at that point, we had over 400 men in this building and about 140 women next door at the women's shelter in a large congregate environment. So I think, you know, those months were a blur, frankly, when every single day you were trying to figure out, how do we find space for people? How do we get them out of shelter so more people don't get infected? How do we support the staff who have tested positive? You know, we had staff literally who stayed in Boston for months on end in a dorm that BU very lovely let us use because they were afraid to go home to their families. And then what we saw was the numbers start to come down because we, with Healthcare for the Homeless, have been until about a week ago doing universal testing, and that made an enormous difference because we could identify quickly who was positive. At that point, the city and state had brought up both some hotels just for people who were homeless and COVID positive, but also some alternative hotels and dorm space to get people out of shelter quickly. You know, we saw the numbers go down in the summer, just like everyone else. And then we saw this big spike in the fall after the holidays. But I will say this, even since last spring, we've been at less than 2%. After being at 36. Yeah. And right now we're hovering around 1% right now.
So Lindy, you said up until a week ago, you were doing universal testing. What changed a week ago?
Well, two things changed. One is about a month ago, we started vaccines, our first round of vaccines for frontline staff and shelter guests. And our numbers, even before that, were pretty consistently below 2%. And because we have had now probably at least, you know, 3 or 4 months of those very low numbers, I think we and the public health folks and Healthcare for the Homeless thought, you know, we can go to what's called cluster testing, where you take a sample test from, you know, 20 or 30 people. And if you get a positive, then you go back. Right. That's right. And then you go back to the whole group. If you get a positive, if you don't get a positive, you know, you keep doing the cluster testing, you know, in hopes that you pick up the odd case here and there.
So, Lindy, is there a resident, and respecting people's privacy and personal stories, is there a resident or a couple of residents who sort of make you think of the arc, who embody the arc of this experience over the last year? Is there someone whose story you can tell us a little bit about?
You know, I think there's a couple of people. You know, one of the first people here to get COVID was a fellow who has been here probably for about 4 or 5 years. Not an older fellow, in his 50s, had a heart condition, had asthma. You know, heavy-set fellow, so overweight, lovely fellow who was, you know, kind of stuck in homelessness. Every time he tried to get out of here, something else happened, but very, very nice man. He was one of the first people to test positive, within a couple of days, and he ended up in the hospital. He was there for about 3 weeks on a respirator and did not make it. And
oh, I'm sorry.
I think we were all so shocked. You know, we just thought he'd be back after a couple of weeks. It was early on, and I don't think we understood, you know, the severity of this disease, frankly. And also, he was young. And so we thought, oh, you know, so what that he's got a heart condition? You know, so what? There's these other things. He's young, and this is a disease that really impacts older people. Having said that, you know, we had an older fellow, he's 73 now, who tested positive late last spring, again, ended up in the hospital. And I guarantee you, we all thought, boy, if he comes back, we'll be shocked because he has some health issues. He walked back in here about a month and a half after he left and said, I know you all thought I wasn't coming back, but I'm okay. And can I tell you why, you know, this younger fellow didn't make it? And, you know, this older fellow who we were so worried about is fine now. And he's actually got permanent housing. He's in his own room. So it's run the gamut from just the horrible to the miraculous, frankly.
How is the vaccination process going now?
It's going quite well. Very grateful to, you know, the governor and Secretary Sutters for prioritizing homeless people, because the tools at our disposal, especially in shelter where, you know, it's still a large congregate site, even though the numbers are obviously less than they were. The logistics have been terrific. You know, we've worked with Healthcare for the Homeless. They're doing the actual vaccine administration, but we are doing all the scheduling. We're doing the follow-up, the reminder calls, the tracking. So it's gone quite well. And, you know, we're at about 57% of our frontline eligible staff have been vaccinated, and 52% of our eligible guests have been vaccinated.
Is the goal 100%, or is it lower than that?
I think the goal is 70%. If we can get there, you know, we're seeing the same kind of resistance that other people are seeing. Some is fear that these vaccines were approved quickly and they, you know, there wasn't enough time for deep due diligence. Some is suspicion, you know, among Black and brown people about, you know, past experiences with the healthcare system and a lot of wait and see. I want to see how my buddy does. I want to see how my coworker does. You know, do they get really sick or just sit for a day and they're back at work? So I think it will go up, but I think it's going to be a slower process going forward.
So, Lyndia, and one of the things I want to ask you in our remaining time, what is not visible to people who are not experiencing homelessness or working with those who are, that we need to understand as other members of the community in terms of challenges, needs? What's invisible that needs to be made visible?
You know, I think the emotional toll that this homelessness takes on people to begin with, you know, just walking in here creates an enormous amount of trauma in your life. You know, it means things have pretty much fallen apart and you have no friends, family, no support system to fall back on. And I think this has magnified that feeling of just, you don't have anybody and that you have so few choices left. You know, I remember talking to this young man who was in his 20s, who lost his housing because of COVID. He was couch surfing. He wasn't on the lease in this apartment and he was asked to leave. And he said to me, you know, I didn't want to come here. And I said, yeah, I know. Nobody actually wants to come to shelter. And he said, well, I didn't want to come because I was afraid I was going to get COVID. And he said, but what choice did I have? I got kicked out of the apartment. I could have stayed outside, put myself at risk outside, or put myself at risk here in shelter. And I think for those of us who have choices and who have options, it's hard for people to understand when you have no options. And then even when you try and create an option, oftentimes so many things push back on you. And I think that's, homelessness was so hard before this. And it's even harder now. And people are desperate to get out of shelter in what is still a pretty expensive housing market.
So Lyndia, last question for you. How are you, your team, your residents, staying hopeful and centering around hope, given the challenges that you just laid out?
Well, listen, I will say people are tired. I think we're all collectively tired, right? The whole community, and not just us, right? The entire city's tired. and I think people are, feeling on the one hand, just it's been a year. Nobody expected it to go on this long. So I think there's just this long, it's been a long trajectory. I think people miss seeing each other on a regular basis. You just can't get your head around someone or hug someone and, you know, have a more intimate conversation on Zoom. But there's two hopeful, I would say there are two hopeful things. One is, you know, the vaccines are going quite well and we're going to keep at it. And the day we started vaccines, you know, it was like a little party down here. People were just elbowing and smiling and just talking to each other and just very excited about it. So it really felt like there was some light at the end of the tunnel. I think the second thing I would say is we are
just
really,
briefly,
really
Lyndia,
pushing
just
on
so
more
you know
housing.
We're running out of time.
Yep. More housing.
More housing.
And that's the hopeful thing.
That's great. I'm sorry to cut you off there because that's an important point too. Always a joy to have you. Lyndia Downey is the president and executive director of Pine Street Inn, the city's largest homeless shelter. Lyndia, thank you.
Thank you.